Welcome to Business Trip, a podcast about the business of psychedelics. I'm Greg Kubin, and my co-host is Matthias Serebrinski. Matthias and I are partners at PsyMed Ventures, a fund investing in psychedelic medicine and mental health. This is part two of our three-part series about psychedelic research at Stanford University. Stanford is taking a multidisciplinary approach to studying psychedelic science, with researchers collaborating across departments. In today's episode, we speak to Boris Heifetz, an assistant professor at Stanford's School of Medicine. Boris also leads the Heifetz Lab, which is dedicated to understanding and improving on powerful, rapid-acting therapies for psychiatric disease, such as ketamine, MDMA, and psilocybin. Boris is an anesthesiologist and neurologist, a combination that uniquely positions him to design a study to evaluate the effects of ketamine on patients under anesthesia with depression. In other words, if a depressed patient is under anesthesia and receives intravenous ketamine, will their symptoms improve? How about compared to a placebo group? In this episode, we'll discuss his findings, as well as one other of Boris's studies that examines the effects of set and setting on mice. Matthias was on babysitting duty at the time of this recording, so I'll be leading this interview with Boris Heifetz. Briefly share your title and what you study at Stanford.
Oh, I'm excited to be here. You know, we've gotten familiar with folks in the industry. This is very, very new territory. My mama told me that I should never go into business because I have no common sense. She's probably right. But there's a whole lot of opportunity to shape an emerging field. So I'm an assistant professor of anesthesiology, and it's the Department of Anesthesiology, Perioperative, and Pain Medicine. And I'm also a neuroscientist. I did a MD and a PhD in basic neuroscience, like the physiology of synapses and plasticity in various parts of the brain. And right now, I'm running both basic neuroscience, meaning like mouse studies, as well as human trials with, I would broadly define, psychedelic compounds. We're going to throw ketamine in there because it's a lot easier to get a hold of and use than psilocybin. But obviously, we have to respect the distinction between these drugs. And then a day a week, I'm in the operating room taking care of patients undergoing neurosurgery.
Cool. Why are you interested in studying psychedelics?
I did all of my field research in the 90s in college, and that was a very profound experience. I think that's why a lot of people got started in this. And one of the things that struck me even at the time is I was a pretty type A overachiever type kid. Got into Yale, got very excited. My parents were very excited and started to burn out pretty quickly. And I wanted to know what, expand the scope of my life a little bit and connect with other people more and venture beyond things that are going on in the classroom. And that's where I first encountered psychedelics generally. And over the course of a few years during college afterwards, it was already sort of obvious to me that these could have profound effects on your concept of self and your relationships. But it was similarly clear that relationships that revolved around the use of psychedelics and other substances were not particularly stable or did have a lot of longevity. So this concept very early on I was introduced to called sober time. I don't know if that's a concept that exists outside of our little circle, but it was this idea that there has to be a foundation in order to grow these things. And without that, you can have a lot of not great outcomes. And for a college student, not great outcome means something very different than what we're talking about in large scale clinical trials, where suicidality is a very bad outcome. So the scale is obviously different. But that was sort of the personal experience that introduced me to the idea of this tremendous raw potential of this class of drugs. And the first thing I did after college is look for a job where I could be involved in this type of research. And that actually brought me in 1999 to UCSF, which at the time was doing the only human studies with MDMA in the country. Up to that point, I'd kind of sublimated my interest in this into working into a basic neuroscience lab at Yale, like studying mechanisms of drug addiction, which at the time is really the only way you could study the drugs at all, really. It was in the context of the neurobiology of drug use. But I wanted to see what else was out there. And that's where I worked in Rhys Jones and John Mendelsohn's lab at UCSF. That's where I met Matt Baggett, who's now the CEO of Tactogen. He introduced me to, he took me to Sasha Shulgin's ranch. Me, a 22-year-old, not knowing my ass from my elbow. And I didn't really appreciate it at the time or what an exciting thing that was, although I knew who Sasha was. So that sort of got me introduced into clinical research with psychedelics. And it was also very obvious to me how far it was to go. Nobody was funding this kind of work. The kind of work that we were doing with Rhys and John was just basic. How long does it take MDMA to clear out of your blood, right? This basic foundational information, but a far cry from we're going to use this to treat PTSD in 50 million people. In that year, I also worked on the investigational new drug application. Rick Doblin had already formulated MAPS and they were starting to get together the application for the FDA for the first trial. And that didn't happen, I think, till 2006. So even 6 years before that, I was, for $10 an hour, reading through papers on giving pigeons MDMA and what happens and trying to summarize all the safety data. So anyway, that was a very formative experience. And then there was a long arc where I did what I was advised to do, which is do something respectable and very kind of mainstream. And that's led me down this path of MD and PhD and studying things that were kind of more mainstream, like synaptic physiology, plasticity, endocannabinoids was as exciting as it got at the time. And then I got to Stanford for anesthesia residency, and that's where I met up with my mentor, Rob Malenka, and then we continued to collaborate afterwards. I met Alan Schatzberg, who was a former chair of psychiatry at Stanford as well, and they really mentored me when I got here on how to do high-level basic science and clinical science. And they were both very interested in this emerging field, which is pretty lucky because they didn't really give a shit anymore. But they have to make people happy. They can kind of go where the science leads them. And that sort of brings me to where we are right now. So that was a very long answer, but that's how I got interested in psychedelics.
Yeah, no, I love that. I mean, it sounds like a lifelong interest in pursuit. It sounds like through your detour, you also learned some skills and became proficient in areas that you actually are now able to integrate into your research.
That was the goal. And that was one of the perspectives I bring that's a little bit different from, I think, a lot of other folks in the field is I'm not a psychiatrist. That is on purpose. Like, I did a psych rotation at Bronx Psychiatric Institute, saw some of the real severe psychiatric disease. And then I did a rotation in the OR. And after doing 4 or 5 years of a PhD where you give a drug and you see an effect and you can study real-time physiology and pharmacology, it was to me like a visceral moment of enlightenment when I left the hospital and I was not depressed. I didn't want to run screaming, figure out how fast can I get through residency. Anesthesia was like a much more immediate feedback kind of view. It's like applied neuroscience in a way that psychiatry is quickly becoming, but really is not set up for. So this idea of being able to do these big manipulations of consciousness, which we do for clinical endpoints, right, to anesthetize people for surgery, has a very obvious application in these other areas now where we're doing, it's in a different direction, obviously. Psychedelics is a very different sort of manipulation. But this idea of doing these big manipulations, some of which really do have unknown safety profiles, that's something that I learned in anesthesia is crisis management and patient safety is the cornerstone of our specialty. It's probably one of the safest areas of medicine right now when you think about just the numbers of people involved, the things that we're doing to them, and being able to get patients through that safely. So that's the perspective that I'm looking at these at psychedelics with, and that informs a lot of the writing that we do. It's this idea that MDMA, psilocybin, ketamine, ibogaine, these have tremendous potential and also a not insignificant amount of risk attached, right? And it's a tricky road because a lot of people will say that part of the value of these drugs is in the risk, right? That like, it is chaotic. It has to be a little bit. There has to be an element of risk for it to work. And I think that's probably true to a large extent. But so how do you thread that loop, right? In the OR, if somebody has chest pain, you're done. Like, you don't go forward with an elective hip replacement, right? So it's a very different kind of concept of risk. And I know psychiatry grapples with risk. It's its own sort of framework for dealing with that. So that's a little bit of the difference in, I think, how I see this field from some of my colleagues.
Yeah. So let's get into one of the studies that you conducted recently that feels like it's at this intersection of psychedelics and anesthesiology. So the first study I want to talk about is studying the effects of ketamine on anesthetized patients with depression. So what was the intention of that study?
The intent was everybody asked the same couple questions about psychedelics. How much does the trip matter? Ketamine is in that family. And again, it's not the same as psilocybin or MDMA. It's its own thing. But this question has been raised many times is how much is the dissociation, that the impact of the drug on your acute subjective experience, how important is that for the clinical outcome we observe, which is this improvement in depression scores, which has been observed many times. So that was the question that we're addressing. And the arena that we have to work in was we anesthetize patients every day. So by definition, they're not aware of what's going on. This is a very convenient place to test this hypothesis, which is if you don't know that you got ketamine or you didn't experience it, do you still get a benefit from it afterwards?
And what was the study design?
So the design emulated a number, like probably a dozen ketamine studies that have been performed over the last 10 years, in that we took patients with moderate to severe major depressive disorder that we diagnosed, and we used standard measures. We randomized patients to either receive ketamine or placebo during general anesthesia, the maintenance phase of general anesthesia, meaning when things are kind of cruising along in the OR. Patients are very much unconscious. And we dosed it the same way that previous studies had dosed it, 0.5 mg/kg infused over 40 minutes. And then our outcomes were, again, mirroring previous studies where we looked at where the peak effect of ketamine should be, which is in the first 3 days after infusion. And we look at depression scores and compare ketamine versus placebo in terms of the magnitude of change from before to after.
And what was the result?
So I can tell you the result I wanted to see, which is the most interpretable result would be that the placebo line is flat because there's no longer a placebo effect, and the ketamine, you get this big effect. It's not what we saw. We saw a massive treatment effect in both groups that was indistinguishable, meaning, and when I say a massive effect, I mean, looking at, again, 10 years worth of ketamine studies in awake patients, what routinely people see is 50 to 60% response, meaning their symptoms cut by half, and in the neighborhood of 30% remission, meaning they no longer meet criteria for depression in those days after the infusion. That's exactly what we saw in both groups. We're able to see the same magnitude of response in both placebo and ketamine groups in that time afterwards. That was really the big surprise. The interpretation is not straightforward. We weren't expecting the results, so we didn't design the study to get at all of the things that now I wish we had. But let's just go through the options briefly of what each type of result might have meant. Worst result you can get is no effect in either group. Right? Because then you can say, well, why did anesthesia block ketamine's effect? It means that you must need to dissociate. But the alternative is that, well, ketamine's effect is just blocked by anesthetics for some sort of molecular interaction. That didn't happen. Rather, by the fact that we did see an effect strongly suggests that a similar process is occurring in our population as in the populations that have been studied year after year. We did get the same ketamine effect. The key difference, and this is important, it revolves around blinding. And this is something that was not really explicit in the way I describe our initial question. The question I asked is dissociation important, right? That acute effect. The other side of that is as soon as you start dissociating, you know what group you're in. There is this moment in every psychedelic trial where a patient basically wins or loses the clinical trial lottery. I've been starting to think of as a moment of betrayal, right? Either success or betrayal, where you try really hard, you beat out 100 other contestants, you enroll in a trial, And then at that moment in the office, or in the, when you have the eye shades on and nothing's happened, you're like, why did I waste all this time? Like, all for what? And that could be a big letdown. We've talked to patients who've had that experience. And on the flip side, that confirmation that, like, I got it, this is it, and it doesn't work out that way for everyone. Some people don't get a benefit, even though they are in the active treatment group. But there is this sort of confirmation of, I got what I came for. And if you think about this like a lottery, I start to wonder how much of the effect in these clinical trials of psilocybin, MDMA, ketamine is just the difference between winning and losing that game of roulette, basically. And it in our case, right, so when everyone's anesthetized, what happens is there's never that moment of unblinding. They all come in with expectations. Everybody comes in with expectations. And not everybody made it into the study. All of those elements are still there. And when we asked them, what drug do you think you got? They were totally unable to predict. They were wrong half the time. It's a perfectly blind study. But their answers tended to reflect how whether they got better or not. So if they got better, they thought they got ketamine, again, reflecting their expectation that ketamine is therapeutic. If they didn't get better, they thought they were in the control group. So that is really the key, is that interaction between expectation and unblinding is really a big bug in psychedelic clinical trials and interpreting the results. Our result doesn't mean ketamine doesn't work. That's not what this, we don't have enough data to say that. What we can say is that the placebo effect, and I'm using air quotes for the audio listeners, is a pretty complicated thing. It's a real physiological process. And when you really let it shine by not telling people that they're in the placebo group, then that can account for a very large component of ketamine's effect. We should be harnessing that. We shouldn't be trying to discard it. We shouldn't be trying to use it to fool children. Like, I have a headache, here's a sugar pill. It's a real thing. It's almost certainly a component of psychedelic efficacy. Again, almost certainly. That's me saying stuff without any real evidence to back it up. But that's what our ketamine trial, I think, shows, is just how big of a role the expectancy and placebo can play, and that maybe our true effect sizes, like drug-specific effect, are maybe a little bit smaller.
Hmm. Do you have a hypothesis for how patients would respond to other compounds under anesthesia that are not ketamine?
Of course. I'll make hypotheses all day. That's like our stock and trade. And it's easy because there's no money riding on it. It's just science. At first, we thought, like, we're just going to wash, rinse, repeat with psilocybin. It's taught us two things, is that if we're going to do this with psilocybin, the first thing is we have to learn how to modify expectancy. Right. Part of all of this is, what are you signing up for? From a patient's perspective, are you signing up for a therapeutic trial of the most exciting new thing in medicine? Or is this just something where you can get a couple $100 to do a sleep study? Right. That's a very different sort of expectations. And that's what we're playing with in this next phase. But what I expect is there's a couple groups, is that Wisconsin and Michigan are also very interested in this. We're trying to get people to sleep and then giving them psilocybin. And my prediction is that it's going to be very difficult to stay asleep on psilocybin. My guess is you're going to have some wild dreams that are going to be very difficult. There's going to be an experience of psychedelics under the influence of anesthesia. It's not going to be this like black memory hole. So what we're doing is we're prepping a safety study now, basically to just look at what happens to people under escalating doses of psilocybin during a moderate plane of sedation. And it's really to get at that question, is, are they going to get delirious? Are they going to have wild dreams? How much are they going to remember? Are they going to tag it as a psychedelic experience at all? And so that has led us into the other very interesting territory, which is one thing that you can now play with is, well, what if you can induce a dream state without psychedelics? How does that compare? If this is now you have the situation where you have a chance to keep people in the dark, so to speak, about what drug they took, but give them a comparable experience, one being a psychedelic-induced dream. I don't know what's going to happen. Or we've been developing an anesthetic technique that allows these prolonged periods of dreaming without awakening that might be received similarly by patients, and patients might tag those experiences as psychedelic without knowing what they got. So I have no idea what's going to happen. I'm very excited to find out, and we still have a bunch of paperwork to work through before we get there.
Interesting. A couple other quick questions on this study. One, is part of your thinking behind this research that you think if there is a delta between the anesthetized folks who are given a psychedelic versus not, and the people who are given have some sort of therapeutic relief, do you think that there's application like in the clinic? Is the idea that this is something that actually could be a future treatment?
So the short answer is, I think we've already pitched this to a couple of VCs, and I learned very quickly about what is important in trying to scale a product. And I can tell you that requiring a board-certified anesthesiologist to watch someone for an hour is not, it's not scalable in most people's opinions. But the idea that you can have short outpatient procedures at controlled cost is not crazy. But in terms of the scalability, this really is trying to get at a crucial question, which is the trip an epiphenomenon? What I mean by that is if I wandered into your brain and made all of your neurons bloom dendrites simultaneously, and that was therapeutic, what a hypothesis has been elaborated, how would you interpret that experience? Right? You don't necessarily, the experience isn't necessarily primary, but it is like a byproduct of this therapeutic process. I don't know that's going on, but it's at very least like we should get an answer to that. That's something that David Olson, Brian Roth, other groups around the country are developing non-hallucinogenic psychedelics. I should say non-hallucinogenic drugs that are psychedelic analogs that can test that idea where you get some of these plasticity changes, but without triggering this big subjective response. That's one way to approach it. This is another way where it's the same drug. Is this going to be a treatment in the clinic? I don't think so. I think what this, the point of this really is to hone in on what components of this complex package of psychedelic assisted therapy are important for the overall process. And I'm not doing these experiments to prove that you can knock people out and give them psychedelics. That's absolutely not what we're going after. But how do we progress? How do you convince the FDA that you need to formally recognize psychotherapy as an important therapeutic component and also reimburse it at the same level that you would like aftercare after getting like a major cardiovascular intervention? That to me is what we're trying to enshrine is if we think it's important, if we think that psychological support, subjective experience, monitoring, and the therapy component is important, we have to show it in a rigorous way. And that's how I think we go forward.
How did you get this study approved through the institutional review board? So the first one with ketamine, the one with psilocybin, are there any concerns around this as a concept to the IRB?
So psilocybin, we're duking it out still. No one has combined psilocybin and anesthetics in a clinical trial yet. Our IRB is very diligent. Their expertise is not comprehensive. This is a very unique area of medicine, and that's, I would argue, we do some very dangerous things in the operating room. You get a new kidney, you get a new hip. This is really, we should be thinking about this the same way. There's some risk under monitored care that you should be able to accept in order to get a benefit. Right. So if we think that we can use this, this experiment that we're doing, the study that we're doing is going to lead us to better therapy, there is some element of risk that we can assume that is appropriate. Mm-hmm. And this is really where this patient safety background comes in, which is all we do is risk stratification and mitigation. And so I don't think it's fundamentally unsafe in any way. There is a safe way to do these things. And I think the IRB in general has been very easy to work with. We've been approved to do non-surgical anesthesia in depressed patients where there's no other indication for anesthesia other than we want to do this mechanistic study. Again, that's appropriate because anesthesia is one of the safest procedures that you can get. It's done millions of times a year around the world with a very low complication rate that's related to the anesthesia itself. This is a big change from 40 years ago.
Cool. Yep, makes sense. Let's move on to the next study. So let's discuss the study that you conducted around the importance of set and setting using mice. So what was the intent of this study?
So there are some things you can't do in humans yet, and it's related to understanding mechanism and trying to understand how brain activity and behavior and drugs are all related. And we've known for a long time that there's a lot of things. A drug is not just a drug. It's a drug in a context often. If you take amphetamine in a novel environment and you're a mouse, you'll run around much less than if you take it in your home familiar environment. So it's really, there's a contextual component to drug effects that if you think about drugs mechanism more broadly than just a receptor. It binds this receptor or that receptor. But there's a context in which all these things happen, a behavioral context. It's not really reflected by receptor pharmacology. It's a moving system that you're inserting. What's the effect of running red lights in Manhattan at midnight versus at 5 p.m.? They're very different, right? Context is very important, and we should be incorporating that into drug action. So that was the idea of a very simple experiment where we just make as big a change in a mouse's environment as we could and test psilocybin in both of the, versus a placebo-like drug, though there's no real placebo effect in mice, but versus a control in mice. And the basic setup was we give either what we believe to be a hallucinogenic-like dose of psilocybin or just a control solution to mice and either put them in their familiar home cage where they hang out with their buddies, or the mouse rave. That's where they have all these things to climb on and like things to sniff and colors to see. And it's still a social environment. And the idea here, like what led to this question, is psychedelic therapy, the way it's structured right now, this didn't come from nowhere, this idea of very carefully controlled settings, whether you have the non-denominational whatever paintings and whatever you have going on in the room. It's like it's a dimly lit room that's comfortable as a couch. You put on eye shades, you listen to music. We pay attention to the set list that people are playing. And there's a question like, does it really matter that you do that in a therapist's office? So that's sort of a big scalability issue. People are reporting the same sorts of things at Burning Man. And when you think about what people describe, even in that therapist office, I don't know that you can constrain the chaos of a psilocybin trip just by reducing the ambient noise. That trip is going to take hold regardless of the setting. The setting can play a role independently. Like you get therapy at a therapist's office, not in a supermarket. So that was really the question that drove this, is how much, when we look at just brain activity writ large, right? Whole brain imaging to look at neural activity as a readout for a brain state. How much does drug contribute? How much does environment contribute? And is there an interaction? So how much does environment modify the effect of the drug independently of just the environment having its own thing?
Yeah, and what was the result?
Well, so the result is we were expecting this huge interaction that like you'd have access to these psychedelic states at the mouse rave that are just impossible to achieve in the home cage. But we really were surprised at how little of an interaction there was. We saw a big effect. This is a statistical model where you can look at the effect of environment, the effect of drug, and the interaction. When you look at environment, we saw a big effect of environment. That's what we expected. That's what we were aiming for, right? Lots of brain activity all over the cortex spiking up in the novel environment. We saw a big effect of psilocybin, also not surprising, and so we were aiming for. And it was pretty different from the effect of the environment. There's areas of overlap, but there's also areas of non-overlap. And then when we went to look for that interaction, meaning are there effects of psilocybin that are radically different depending on what environment you're in, we saw very little. And that was a big surprise. There were a couple areas that we did find. Imagine like scanning the entire brain and finding two little nuggets of brain tissue that show an interaction. That means, number one, that those might actually be quite important, but also that the interaction, the thing that really, like this idea of like getting, of setting specific psychedelic states that are only accessible in certain areas, it's not as common as you might think. Like it really, you're talking about a very narrow set of circumstances that are going to lead to that type of effect, that interaction. And this is what kind of made me rethink almost everyone's intuition.
So you talked about the intent, you talked about the design of the study, you talked a bit about the results. Really, what I'm hearing is that you did not see a discernible effect between the mice that were injected with psilocybin and the mice that were injected with placebo based on their environment, based on their setting.
Yeah, I'll restate it a little bit differently as well. As it's not that there aren't different, that your experience is obviously going to be different if you're taking psilocybin on the beach, sipping margaritas versus in a therapist's office. Those are two different experiences. But the question is, are they the sum of the effect of being in a therapist's office versus on the beach plus psilocybin? Or are there specific patterns of brain activity, psychedelic brain states that are only accessible in certain environments? That's an interaction. That's really what we mean. So the counterpoint, for example, would be MDMA, where we have data that being in a social environment fundamentally alters the effect of the drug, that it's almost a different drug when it's taken in a social setting versus a non-social setting. That's an interaction where your setting does change the effect of the drug, both on brain activity and behavior. So psilocybin seems to be a bit different. Looking now, reinterpreting what we, some of the clinical literature, why is it that we're, a lot of people say it doesn't matter what's going on around you, right? You put on the eye shades, you're suppressing all of this input. It's very much driving the trip inward. I think that's been where some of the practices have evolved from. And that speaks to the fact that it's really not about like where you are. It's about who you are and what you've been going through. Now, that's something we haven't addressed that in mice, but it's an important distinction to make. And especially when you start thinking about how do you scale this treatment and what kind of therapy do you need to have go along with it? It maybe suggests that the aftercare, like, and the preparation, like those are probably very important. We can't really say much about that from this, but the actual setting in which it happens, like how much do we need to obsess about how many lumens are in the room and stuff like that? What color is the carpet? Like probably not a lot. The drug is going to do its thing. Again, it's a study in mice and we have to take that limitation really up front, but it leads us when we see brain activity in a mouse, we can relate that to brain activity in a human. And it can take us much further in terms of understanding mechanism when we can see some of the same patterns emerge across species.
Yep. I have a couple other questions which we can do in rapid fire format. First question is, based on your research and general worldview, would it be fair to say that you have skepticism about the therapeutic effects of psychedelics?
I think they are profoundly therapeutic, but not in a way that is easily captured by things like the DSM. My personal view is that the war on drugs is like a abject failure, that we should not be putting people in prison for possession and use of psychedelics. That is a personal view that doesn't reflect where I work or anything else. But in order to go to do this through the system, like if you want to medicalize these things and get them deregulated and approved, you need to put them in a medical container. And that medical container doesn't really perfectly align, or maybe doesn't even align that well with what these treatments are doing. Wellness, well-being, creativity. We're repleting somebody's propofol deficiency, you know, when they're getting too. Anyway, I think you get what I'm saying.
What is your biggest pet peeve about psychedelic research?
Where do I start? Let's see. Poorly controlled open label clinical trials. It makes me crazy. That is probably my biggest pet peeve, is trying to draw any kind of conclusion. I've done it myself, so I understand why these things happen the way they do, but it just lends itself to so much misinterpretation when you compare someone before treatment and after treatment with no control. There are so many things. We know this. We keep talking about how important all the stuff is around psychedelic therapy, yet we're willing to attribute all of this change to what's in the pill. I think that makes me crazy.
Okay, so earlier in the conversation, you talked about ketamine and questioned it as a psychedelic. I've done intramuscular ketamine, the very first episode of Business Trip. I did it with Ed Mindbloom, and I was launched into the universe, and I really had the sensation of leaving my body, felt connected to something much bigger than myself, and for me, it did feel quite psychedelic. So what is the distinction there in terms of your thinking of it as a psychedelic or not?
The distinction is pissing off the lumpers and the splitters. I mean, I think there's clearly overlap. Ketamine, I've had similar experiences to what you described. There are definite similarities in the quality of the experience to classic serotonergic psychedelics. There are also pretty big differences. It's not easy to just say it's this and not that. So I think what really binds these different compounds together is they're strongly psychoactive, and they can change your life potentially under some conditions that we haven't really characterized yet and change your perspective.
Yep. Last question. What do you want to study next?
We are very intent on trying to explore that window between psychedelic states, psychedelics, dreams, anesthesia. Like, these things are coming together in a way I'm very surprised about. And seeing how far, that's what most of our mouse work is ultimately aimed at, for me, is trying to induce these same sorts of states in much more precise ways, prosocial and pathogenic states, without the use of a drug. This is, in some ways, old technology. People, experienced meditators maybe, like people who've done a lot of work on themselves, can achieve those states. But we want to lower the barrier. And we're basically trying to build a roadmap of how to do that, either with brain stimulation techniques or maybe novel drugs that work a little bit differently. But inducing these states of consciousness that have never really been experienced in human history, that to me is very exciting. And it'll take a little while.
Well, Boris, thank you so much for joining us on the pod. If you have any closing thoughts, the mic is yours.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I actually will leave with one thought. We keep talking about the hype cycle. And people keep thinking we're in the late part, the part where you're approaching enlightenment. And I think we're not even at peak hype yet. There's a whole lot of disappointment and promise, but there's a very long way to go with the industry and the therapy.
So you're saying the trip is long. The trip is long.
That's a good way to sum it up.
All right. Fantastic. Thank you, Boris.
Thanks, Greg.
This is Business Trip, a podcast about the business of psychedelics. If you'd like to learn more about Boris's anesthesia study, a preprint of the study is in the show notes. And tune into part 3 of our 3-part series about Stanford's psychedelic research. We'll be chatting with Carolyn Rodriguez all about OCD and how she's studying psychedelics' ability to treat it. If you like this episode, you can help us by subscribing to the podcast and leaving a review. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at SciMedVentures. And if you're building a company in frontier mental health, hit us up at hi@scimed.ventures, which you can find in the show notes. I'm Greg Kubin, and my co-host is Matthias Serebrinski. Our producer and editor is Jonathan Davis, with production coordination from Caitlin Nur. Sound design and engineering came from Nico Ray. Our theme music is by Dorian Love, and additional music credits are in the show notes. This is Business Trip. Thanks for tripping with us. We'll see you next time. See you.